Welcome to Catch a Mac Science. I'm Kathleen Gustafson. Once a month on Saturday from 11 a.m. to noon, Catch a Mac Science will provide a platform for discussion, inquiry, and peer review of local science. In the second part of this program, you're going to hear from Sue Mauger, the science director at Cook Inlet Keeper. She talks about her recent Antarctic expedition with Homeward Bound Leadership Initiative, developed to encourage women in the sciences to collaborate, conspire, and mentor. But first, sea star wasting is the topic for discussion. Today you'll hear from Brenda Konar and Katrine Eichen from NOAA's Kositsna Bay Lab. To start it off, here's Seth Spencer, the Education Program Coordinator for the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies.
I do all the logistics and training for our fall and spring Alaskan Coastal Ecology programs, and then fill in throughout the year on all sorts of other programs that our organization does, and one of which is doing some citizen science, including monitoring for sea star wasting disease.
You and Katie Gavinas mm-hmm. have been doing this research. For how long has the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies been involved in sea star wasting study?
So Katie Gavinas worked with the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the Rocky Intertidal Network in 2014 to set up this protocol within Kachemak Bay for three specific locations, one of which was Otter Rock in Peterson Bay, another was right off the dock of the Peterson Bay Field Station, also in Peterson Bay, and finally a small section of beach within Chinaput Bay. Since summer 2014, we've been doing monitoring about every 3 months.
First, let's start with what is sea star wasting?
Sure. Pretty much in summer of 2013, people started noticing along the Pacific coast of California, Oregon, and Washington. And what they were noticing was high rates of mortality of sea stars. And basically, the sea stars looked like they were melting. And that is kind of what happens, is the sea stars get lesions on their bodies and then slowly fall apart. We have had other times of high mortality in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s along the Pacific coast as well, but this is much more widespread and much higher rates of mortality than in the past. We did not see it in Alaska ever before 2014.
What are the protocols for this study?
So the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies has a slightly different protocol just because we wanted to be as kind of specific to our location as possible. And so what we do every 3 months is we go down into these three parts of Kachemak Bay, and we spend about 45 minutes down on the beach below the high tide line. So kind of when the tide is out, it has to be at least a -1. In each location, we kind of have specific spots that we check for, specifically the true star. And what we're looking for is the amount of true stars that are around in this area, as well as what percentage or what rate of all the sea stars, especially the true stars, have lesions. And so we have four different categories. 0 is a healthy true star. It's great. 1, few lesions, all the way up to 4, where you're basically seeing a ray or a leg or two, and the rest of the sea star has kind of melted. We also have another section of those beaches that we look both above and below the water, or subtidally, for leather stars and sunflower stars. True stars and sunflower stars are highly susceptible to sea star wasting, whereas currently we believe, or the data is kind of showing, that maybe leather stars are able to kind of fend off this wasting a little bit better. We've actually seen higher rates of leather stars kind of throughout this whole time compared to any other sea star.
When you go out is dependent upon the tide, so it could be the middle of the night.
Spring and summer are great. It's usually 10, 11, 12 o'clock in the morning. Fall and winter can be very challenging because those -1 tides are often at 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. And so you are having to go out onto the beach with very powerful flashlights and occasionally snowing as you're going on the beach trying to find these sea stars that might be under ledges or rocks. After kind of the major outbreak of sea star wasting within Kachemak Bay in August of 2016, these were pretty slow surveys. We'd go out in October, November, and January and February, and we might see 10 sea stars in 2 hours of surveys. Some of these sea stars, especially the true stars, are rebounding a little bit. We're seeing juvenile or kind of smaller sea stars at pretty normal levels, but we are not seeing a lot of adults.
the data you collect is something you're sharing with a network. That isn't your findings.
No, that's a very good point. So we actually have probably two sets of data. One is that we're collecting for the Rocky Intertidal Network, which is a group of nonprofits and federal and state agencies throughout the Pacific Coast that are keeping track of whether certain sea star species, including true stars, sunflower stars, ochre stars, have wasting or not. Then the Center for Alaskan Coal Studies, we're also interested in the percentage of sea stars that have this and overall numbers, because that is what we want to kind of know is before the wasting really hit, we might see 100, 150 true stars at a certain tide, whereas now we might be seeing half of that. The Center for Alaskan Coal Studies has kind of its own findings, but this larger network also has their kind of findings. They're able to look at all this data over 250 different sites along the Pacific coast and really show that this round of sea star wasting is unprecedented. It also shows that here in Alaska, we're usually 2 years behind what is happening in California, Oregon, and Washington. And so they had this major outbreak in 2013. In 2015, they started to rebound a little bit. And then in 2017, the last October, November, unfortunately, parts of the Puget Sound area had another round of wasting kind of go through. And so here in Ketchikan Bay, possibly because we have cooler water, might be another couple years before we have another round of wasting. But we're hopefully going to recover a little bit, especially with our ochre and true stars. Unfortunately, the data that we're collecting is not showing that sunflower stars, the really large, beautiful sea stars that were once very common, have rebounded pretty much at all. We're usually seeing maybe 5 to 10 juveniles, not very large at all, when we go out and do these surveys over the last 2 years.
And I want to ask about how your data is represented and mm-hmm. how you engage with it after you've collected it.
Yeah, so that's always the hard thing. We go out and we do a lot of education, but it doesn't mean a whole lot unless we're able to share that data with a wider audience. And that can be the hardest thing, and it's sometimes beyond what I have the skill set to do, because I can take this data and put it on a graph and create some bar charts and line graphs. And sometimes that can work for understanding of what's going on, and sometimes it can make no sense at all. Our organization has really worked to try to represent this data so that it shows what we believe is happening from the data. And that really is how large the sea stars are over the last 3 years, because that's one thing we're noticing is that, of course, with juvenile sea stars being the only ones around right now, this overall median size has almost halved over the last 3 years. What we are seeing is that coming up to 2016, when we had that major outbreak, we had maybe 5-10% of all the sea stars we saw with wasting. You come into August 2016, and it goes up to about 90% of the sea stars we were seeing. Well, now it's down to about 0-3%, depending on the survey. But you also can't just take that data and say, hey, we're having this great rebound, because it doesn't always take into account that most of the sea stars that possibly were susceptible to wasting have died. And that especially is true of the sunflower stars. Usually we do see more sea stars in the summer, so I am really interested to see what's going to happen over the next 6 months. One thing we haven't really talked about is with sea star wasting, researchers are trying to figure out why is it being passed so quickly. There were theories of it has to do with water temperature or possibly proximity. If you had thousands of sea stars all very close together, the virus would pass very quickly through them. And when I say virus, that is one of the ways that we believe, or researchers had a thought up until about the last year, that sea star wasting was kind of being pass from sea star to sea star. Unfortunately, the most recent data that I've seen is kind of inconclusive on whether it is a denzovirus. There's something called sea star denzovirus, which sea stars have, and then sea stars with wasting have shown that they have this virus. Researchers have found that maybe they're not exactly linked, and so we don't know exactly, and that can be incredibly frustrating. At the Center for Alaska Coal Studies, we get lots of people stopping in and asking us, what's going on with our sea stars? How do we prevent it? And
do people text you photographs all the time of things they're finding on the beach?
Yeah, so one really cool thing that we have here in Homer is the Ketchikan Bay Nature Watch Facebook page. We have about 1,000 members on that group, and people have been really great over the last couple of years when they go out tide pooling If they see a sea star, they'll take a picture. If they see a sea star with wasting, they were definitely taking pictures. And so that's just been kind of a really interesting way to see, not necessarily live data, but just have a general idea of where these things are happening, because maybe a general citizen is not going to upload their data to this Rocking or Tidal Network website.
You were talking about causes and the virus.
Yeah.
Currently, what you're studying or trying to work out is that it is either passed star to star or solely, or they're all catching it from the environment.
Yeah, and that's what currently researchers don't seem to know, is that in kind of 2014, shortly after the big outbreak, there was some studies done, and this idea of the sea star denzovirus had been known about, but possibly they were seeing higher rates of the denzovirus in sea stars that had died from wasting.
And that, so that would be passed star to star.
Yeah, yeah, and pretty quickly. But then as more research is being done, there are, I guess, parts of Washington that have super high concentrations of the ochre sea star, and those seem to not be impacted, whereas if it was a virus that kind of went from sea star to sea star really quickly, generally the data would kind of show that those sea stars would have died immediately. But for whatever reason, certain populations are doing quite well, and some have been absolutely decimated. The next step research is kind of looking at is both, are we going to have sea stars coming back? So how are those juveniles doing? And that's one thing the Center for Alaska and Coastal Studies keeps our eye out for, as we keep track of juvenile or small sea stars, what size they are, how healthy they are, where we're finding them. And then the next step is, what are the overall ecological impacts of all these sea stars disappearing?
Are you making a plan to look at impacts?
I know some baseline studies have already been done. Pictures have been taken. Amounts of mussels have been kind of counted where they are on the beach. We often work with university students that visit us in the summer, and that is one study they often focus on, is kind of how especially Otter Rock out in Peterson Bay has changed. Now, we can't say for sure that it has to do with sea stars, but that is one thing that the Rocky Intertidal Network, including Gulf Watch, and so that's NOAA and University of Alaska Fairbanks and the National Park Service, are starting to focus on, is these pretty large predators, also known as keystone species. And the ochre star was pretty much the first keystone species ever described.
What is that?
And that is a species that has a larger than average impact on all the other species around it. And that's a predator that, if they are removed from kind of that food chain, the food chain is impacting much more than any other species around. And so research has shown that those ochre stars and sunflower stars eat a lot of things. They eat a lot of bivalves, and they eat a lot of urchins. And all of a sudden, if we have 90% of those sea stars disappearing, well, some of that prey starts to go crazy. And so there are places along Oregon, Washington that are having urchin barrens. So the urchins population goes really high. Urchins eat all the kelp. Things start disappearing. There are, of course, scientists at Kitsissimmee Bay Lab.
Nice.
And then the Center for Alaska Coastal Studies, we're doing most of our research in that intertidal zone between high and low tide. Places like Kitsissimmee Bay, they have divers that possibly are going down and really seeing the impact. Because that's another thing we don't necessarily know about our sea stars. If all of a sudden a lot of them start dying, do some kind of realize something's going on and they move deeper within the water column. Generally, kind of know that there are seasonal migrations of sea stars from winter to spring to summer to fall. And when we were going out in January, at times it was hard to know if there were very few sea stars because the water was really cold and sea stars didn't want to freeze, or if it was from that wasting. And we had to wait about 6 months until we got to those warmer summer weather to really find that out. Basically, all we can know is that the numbers went down, but it could have been that in January it was kind of a combination of both. Sea star numbers went down and they had migrated because the water is really cold and in the intertidal zone can freeze.
Can you project into the future? Where is the study going?
So the future pieces of the study, we're going to, of course, continue to do this monitoring every 3 months, and probably a little more frequently as we come into the summer, which is generally when we've been seeing wasting, kind of the percentage of sea stars goes that with wasting goes up. And we did see it a few times this winter, and so it's possible that it's going to kind of ramp up as the water temperatures do get a little warmer, as that seems to not necessarily be the cause, but it does kind of just speed up wasting a little bit more. I do think another part of the research that we're going to expand on is possibly the other ecological impacts that reduction of sea star numbers might have on rocky shores, muddy shores, sandy shores. I don't necessarily know what that's going to look like yet. We do want to know what impact are sea stars having on mussels and urchins, and how is that going to change kind of the rest of the beach.
I'm Brenda Konar, and I'm a professor of marine biology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks at the College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
And I am Katrin Eiken, and I am also a professor of marine biology at UAF and Fairbanks at the College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
I've been discussing with Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies about the sea star wasting study that they've been participating in. And Kasitsna Bay Lab also conducts a sea star wasting study.
We've been doing sea star monitoring since the early 2000s, and it used to be part of the Census of Marine Life, and now it's part of a group called Gulf Watch Alaska, and it's actually a Gulf-wide project. And so we've got sites in Kenai and Prince William Sound, Katmai, and we also have quite a few sites here in Ketchumek Bay.
Annually, we do a survey that is typically around May, late April, beginning of May, so this time of year. It is an intertidal survey. So, you know, at the good low tides that we have here, we go out and look for sea stars along defined tidal heights. But then Brenda also teaches a class in the spring and March, and they do some subtidal work, diving, and maybe...
That's in Southeast Alaska, but I do a scientific diving class out of UAF, and then we come down here during spring break and do our diving, our open water diving here at the Marine Lab.
And can you tell me about what your equipment is like and what it means to be surveying in diving equipment?
You put on a snowsuit, and then you put on a giant baggie over the snowsuit, and you put on about 40 pounds of weight, and then you go diving. The water's pretty cold here, particularly in March, and so you have to wear a lot of dive underwear and we wear dry suits to keep ourselves warm and dry, and we wear really good gloves and hoods. And for the class, we do a lot of basic skills and scientific diving type skills. But then as part of the class, we've also been doing the sea star monitoring. So we have certain sites that we've been visiting over the years.
So what are scientific diving skills?
We do a lot of compass skills underwater so that you can navigate. And then we carry around transect tapes, which are like surveyor's tapes, so you can measure distances. And you can also use those tapes to measure the size of sea stars or other things. And then we work a lot on buoyancy. You tend to, if you're new at it and you put on a lot of weight, you tend to go to the bottom, or you don't have enough weight and you go to the top. And so there's a special fine tuning that has to be done so that you can be in the water column, so you're not sort of plowing through the sediment and you're not sitting up on the surface looking down trying to get down.
And one of the purposes of scientific diving is not to just be able to breathe underwater, but it is really to be able to have what Brenda said, you know, good diving skills, buoyancy, so that you then can actually go and do work underwater without impacting the environment by flashing around and destroying everything around you. So learning those skills is important so that then you can go out and, you know, lay out transects. And we do a lot of quadrat work where we have, you know, it's a PVC quadrat basically of a defined area,
so
and then
a,
you can
it's
do
a frame.
It's yeah. a frame,
and
exactly.
You're working within those boundaries.
Correct. And so it's a defined area, and then you can count things within that area or collect from that particular, you know, area. And so it's basically becomes a quantitative study. But you need those skills first before you can do those things.
Is there a video camera on your suit? Because you're not just holding the data, the information in your head.
Well, we carry around clipboards that have a special kind of paper on it. It's a poly paper. It's got like made out of plastic. And so you can write on it underwater. And we just carry clipboards. And so you can write your data on it. But oftentimes we actually collect things too. And we carry around these mesh bags. And so you can put organisms in the mesh bags. You can put your clipboard in the mesh bags. But we also sometimes do carry cameras, and we can do photo quadrats, or we can swim along and do video transects.
You're collecting data. How do you represent and share that data, and who looks at it?
Well, there's multiple levels of that. Most of our data, so we collect them, we process our data on our own home computers and everything. And then the ultimate goal is to make the data, just the raw, basically the raw data available to pretty much anybody who wants them. Probably the raw data are most interesting to other scientists, but that's one of the target groups with whom you want to share, of course. And so there are databases out there where you can put your data that are quality controlled, and then they can be accessed by other people. So for example, we work a lot with AUSS, which is the Alaska Ocean Observing System, and so they have a so-called data portal, and so a lot of our data are available just through that portal. So you can go there, you can find Kachemak Bay data, and then just download basically Excel sheets of data. But we also present our data at conferences. We write our data up in scientific publications. So all of that is probably targeting mostly a scientific audience. We do a fair amount of outreach and trying to present our results and data also to the more general public, because they wouldn't buy a scientific journal to read a paper on something. And so we have in the past contributed to events here that are
the
like
the Kachemak Bay Science Conference that was here just a few months ago. There were quite a few of us from UAF there presenting the work that we've been doing here in the lab.
But isn't there also a little...
The Discovery Labs.
Of the Bay, where we had in the past little blurbs in. We just did something in the Delta Sounder and Prince William Sound out of Cordova. So we're trying to find venues where we can also write about, you know, some of the more interesting research results in a venue that's a little bit more publicly accessible.
Oh, good, because that was my last question, is you are the first people I've encountered whose job it is to interpret and write recommendations. And so where would I go to look for some of that, if there's anything on sea star wasting? Have you made any determinations or recommendations about sea star wasting or figuring out causes or?
Well, there's a group out of Cornell that are looking at the actual virus. It's adenovirus that causes this disease. And so it's known what's causing the disease and how far it's going. And I mean, that's all known. And basically, all we can do at this point is monitor and see when the stars are going to come back. In a few places, like in Prince William Sound, they've had some recruitment events, so they've been seeing little babies, but the babies haven't really been surviving. We're still waiting to see a recruitment event here. We were kind of hoping this time of year we would start seeing a lot of little ones, but we really haven't seen any. There are some stars that survived the disease pretty well. There's the leather star and the blood star. Both of those species still seem to be doing quite well, especially the leather star. If you go diving, there's quite a few of those still around. But there's other species that we lost and we still have not seen, like Pycnopodia, the giant sunflower star that used to be extremely abundant in the bay, and we still have yet to see one.
Not even one.
Mm-hmm. Not even. And we actually, a couple days ago, we dove at like 18 different sites around here, and we didn't see a single one.
I have to tell you that I just talked to Seth Spencer from Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. A study just came out that he was reading that was unable to confirm that the virus was the cause.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure about the details, but it's a pretty strong suspect. I agree that I don't think it has been ultimately proven to be the cause, but it seems that most of it points in that direction. The idea is that probably what contributed to this very, very large outbreak is the quite warm temperatures that we've been experiencing in the last few years. So ultimately, prove this beyond a shadow of a doubt can be very difficult. Where we see our role is not so much in determining the cause of sea star wasting, but maybe more the effects of what we are experiencing here in the Bay. Do we see any changes happening because all of a sudden these sea stars are gone, and if they fill what we presume to be an important ecological role in the natural system, if you take them out, then something should change, right? And so that those are things that we are looking at, and so we're not just looking at sea stars, but we're looking at the entire community, so at all the algae and all the other invertebrates and everything. I don't think we can say that we've seen like a sudden drastic change in the community, but we're observing a few changes that we still need to sort of figure out. Are we fairly confident that they have to do with sea star wasting? Or I just mentioned it's been very warm recently. You know, you don't know. Are things changing because it's warmer, or is it changing because the sea stars are gone? We need to do some more analyses to try to tease apart what, you know, the effects are of different impacts that the systems are experiencing.
It also might take some time because Pycnopodia, the one that used to be really common here, the big sunflower star, eats a lot of clams. And so it could be that in a few years, we might be seeing more clams. And so it might actually be a plus for people. But because clams grow pretty slowly, yes, and it's going to take a while to actually for people to notice of, hey, there's more clams than there used to be here.
And what with all the otters around? I think they're probably going to pick up the slack for any
clams.
Well,
that's the other thing that, you know, you can always assume that, well, if there's some niche, some role that's not being occupied anymore because the sea stars are gone, maybe somebody else will fill that role, but who is it? It's like an intricate network that will take some time to figure out. It's not a clear-cut thing where you just say, this is going down, so this must be going up. It's an interaction web. Trying to tease that apart is not always easy. We are starting to see some changes, and it will be interesting to try to tease that apart. But as Brenda said, it will take some time because none of these things necessarily grow that fast or, you know, reestablish themselves that fast.
We do know that sea stars actually were a pretty big impact on clams. One of my grad students a few years ago, before wasting hit, did a survey at a whole bunch of sites around the Bay, and you can actually look at a clam shell and determine if it was eaten by a sea star or if it was eaten by an otter. And so she did a survey all around the Bay, and in most of her sites, most of the predation on clams was actually by sea stars. There were some by otters, obviously, and there were some areas that were kind of otter hotspots, but in general, she could say that most of the clams here were actually eaten by sea stars.
So if we are going back in, you know, a year or two or whatever and redo a survey, then maybe we could see some impacts.
Yeah.
And where are you headed next? Like today.
Oh, well, today we go back to the lab. We still have
I don't mean in the great, in the large.
we still have a few more sites to sample within our annual Gulf Watch Alaska sampling. We're actually heading over to Western Cook Inlet, Kamishak Bay, around Augustine Island and Douglas Reef, and we'll do some more surveys over there.
That is Katrin Eichen and Brenda Konar. They are professors of marine biology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. We'll circle back to sea star wasting, but let's diverge and hear from Sue Mauger, the science director at Inlet Keeper here in Homer. She had the opportunity to join a group of 77 women from around the world spending 3 weeks aboard the marine vessel Ushuaia, a steel-hulled, ice-strengthened Antarctic research vessel with 33 cabins on 5 decks. Mauger spent the year before departure emailing, Skyping, and getting acquainted with the other women on this Homeward Bound expedition. Homeward Bound is an organization based in Australia dedicated to connecting and supporting women in science all over the world. The participants left the work they do at home and made their focus building relationships and developing leadership strategies. Here's Sue Mauger talking about the 20 days that she spent on a vessel making several stops around Antarctica.
Yep, so we were moving every day to a new location. We did get down across the Antarctic Peninsula, so all the way down there, and then the farthest base that we went to was the Rothera British Antarctic Survey Base.
Yep. And what kind of records did you keep?
So yeah, there was definitely all year long, they really encouraged us to do, I'm using air quotes here, reflective journaling. So, you know, not quite just a personal diary, but something that was really trying to tackle some of these topics that we were talking about all year round, about leadership, about women in science, and some of the obstacles that have popped up in a lot of people's professional lives. But to do it in a writing format that I think for a lot of people really helps to get it out of your head and down on paper. On the ship, we had the wonderful company of a photographer who was there to just capture the energy and the spirit. I have now some really beautiful pictures of not just penguins, because most of us as participants were taking in the whole landscape. And so it was nice to have somebody focusing on us.
Will your notes be made public? Will you be sharing that?
So one of the goals of this program was to be sharing some particular science themes that we were working on. So I was really interested in and how the experience in the Arctic is different than the experience in the Antarctic. And so we did some real deep research on some of the food web dynamics and ice in these two regions. And so all of that information we shared among ourselves on the ship and then are refining those products to be able to share more broadly. But I do hope to do some writing about the science of Antarctica, as well as this process of exploring how women move in the world these days, how our sense of leadership has always been framed in a very masculine way. And so how do women be successful in leadership when no one really sees us that way? It's, I think, one of the things that I really got out of it was this need for really mindful mentoring to encourage women to not only see other women as leaders, but to help them develop the skills that will make them effective.
Were any of your own assumptions challenged when you got there?
Absolutely.
So, like, for instance?
So I think for a lot of my experience in grad school and in professional settings, that there is this real push towards achievement. And especially in the science world, we're measured by published articles and, you know, how much research you're doing and communicating. And what I really have explored and discovered over this last year is the value of building and growing teams of collaborators and partners who are working towards the same vision. I'm much more mindful of the value of spending the time to help grow somebody else's skills, and that is not just about that helping me to get to where I want to go, but that there's great value in the things that you are then planting in that person in terms of what that means for our future collectively.
You feel a responsibility to develop talent.
Yeah, which has never been sort of part of my work plan or really what I felt was an important part of my work as a researcher. Well, and it's one of the challenges when you do grant-funded work.
Because
there's
you've
a product.
Got to come up with something.
Exactly. Part of it is not just educating as an organization, but communicating that to funders and to help them value that they are supporting that development and process that will blossom into lots of different products, not just the one that we wrote when we wrote the grant.
So let's talk gear. What did you have to bring? And was there anything you didn't recognize? Because here, you may have already had all the gear you needed,
well,
or did
I
you?
Well, I had most of the gear, although we had wonderful corporate sponsorship. And all of our pictures are full of, we were all in the same color, this great coral red. And so we stuck out really beautifully against the snow. And we also had these great beanies that were made from women in Nepal. I mentioned we had women from 18 different countries. So some of those countries were Venezuela, Colombia, Uganda, places where they do not have that clothing. And so that was an extra burden for them to get some of that gear pulled together, because there was a lot of time outside. To be honest, the weather was fairly similar to our winter.
But yeah, for people who are coming from the equator, it's a big difference.
Shocking, yes. It was an intense experience to be with this group of women who are all kind of, you know, high achievers.
And very driven.
Very driven, there for a purpose, but yet we were all away from our support systems. You know, we didn't have family, or, you know, some people had kids, and, you know, there was a lot of stress of being away. It had been a financial struggle for some people to be able to go. And add all of that up, plus a leadership program that's asking you to do a lot of introspection and a lot of sharing. There was a lot of bonding that went on. I truly feel like I have, you know, 78 women that I could count on and that I trust and thoroughly enjoyed. So it's
all over the world.
All over the world. So, you know, your extra room is always filled with family and relatives. Well, I'm going to have a lot of homeward bounders on my couch here. We had one other woman from Alaska on the team who lives down in Juneau and does research on otters and seals. And there's also a woman who was on the first team who's up at UAF. And there's a woman in Soldotna on the third team, which will be heading off in December. So I love that there's this little community of homeward bounders growing here as we explore these huge themes. It'll be really nice to have some people that we can, you know, actually be in the same room together rather than just digitally connected.
Did you have to get sponsors to help you get your travel? How did you fund yourself?
Everyone had to come up with $16,000. To pay for our time, the 3 weeks on the ship. Some of that supported some of the leadership team being able to be there as well. Their time was all donated, but they didn't have $16,000 to offer every year for them to be on this ship. There's probably another $4,000 or $5,000 to travel down there. And
so $16,000, not counting your travel to Argentina.
Yeah. One of the things that the first team recommended to improve the program was to have more diversity. And that meant that there needed to be some scholarship slots, because that's just too high a bar for a lot of people. And the goal is actually 10 years of this program to create ultimately 1,000 women who have been through this program.
Who did you get to sponsor you?
So I have been working for Cook and the Keeper for close to 18 years. And so when I was offered the opportunity to go, we sat down and talked about it and talked about its intersection with the work that I do there. And so we worked with some funders, to private foundations, to get the money to support me to go. We had some particular asks through our newsletter if people were interested in supporting my participation in the program. And we definitely had some members that came forward and offered to help with that. You know, people ask, what are you going to do with all this information? And I must admit, it is a lot of brewing going on in my head and a lot of conversations going on with different women from the trip. I don't know the answer quite yet. There are a lot of directions to go to deal with these global problems. Meanwhile, we have some very local challenges going on in Alaska, as we always do. And so finding ways to incorporate these bigger concerns into the work that I do. And certainly when we're thinking about climate change work, you know, the Alaskan stories that I can bring to that global conversation has real value. And so figuring out what that looks like, how do we tell the stories of how climate is impacting life in Colombia and Uganda and Alaska in a way that's compelling in a larger context. So one of the great memories I have of the time on the ship was we would every day, half the day was spent in some of this leadership training. The boat is sort of gently rocking, some days more than others, but we generally had a pretty easy time of it. And someone would be up in the front, you know, our attention fully with them, except that there are windows all along the side of the boat. And so it's difficult to not be gazing outside every once in a while as the boat is
because
moving
to the... spectacular.
It's we're in Antarctica, right? Yes,
sure.
And it is hard to keep your brain focused on this, you know, heady stuff that we're talking about. And we would be moving through this land of ice and someone very earnestly up in the front giving us content. And then someone would yell, "Whales!" And everyone would jump up and run outside. And the poor person at the microphone in the front has to really have some humor about it and not get
upset. They can't compete with whales,
no.
And they know it.
And nor should they try.
Or were there people who'd never seen one?
There are people who had never seen snow. So this moving through ice was an amazing... So we did have iceberg. The first time we saw an iceberg, because, you know, you're going south for a long time and you don't see any of that. And then all of a sudden you begin, you know, your first sign of Antarctica is some of these icebergs drifting north. For some people, it was transformational just in just getting the opportunity to see this landscape.
And forget about it with the penguins.
Well, once we, you know, so the landings with the penguins, and there's nothing more joyful than a penguin or silly. They are the goofiest looking creatures. And if you walk very slowly, they will come fairly close to you. And so you really can have some intimate moments with a penguin. We saw lots of leopard seals, which are quite crazy looking, very lizardy looking seals. And lots of humpbacks and orcas, both of which we see here in Ketchumek Bay. But when you see a humpback moving through icebergs, and it was a very different experience than the way that I've experienced them in Ketchumek Bay.
When conflicts arose, mm-hmm. How did you deal with them?
So we spent the first 2 days down in Ushuaia, Argentina, together to get to know each other before we had to get on the ship and people were maybe going to get seasick. We spent those 2 days talking about how to create a really safe space for us to do this work. And we ultimately came up with some ground rules about how we were going to commit to interacting with each other. The first ground rule was to be kind to yourself and to others. And it was surprisingly challenging. And part of it is because the first part of that is to be kind to yourself. And women particularly can be very hard on themselves. And they have a very strong inner critic that can really change the way they move in the world.
Conditioning that if everybody else is taken care of, then you're okay.
Right. And that you're the last thing you should be thinking about. Well, so this was putting each person first, and in terms of putting yourself in a kind space internally so that you could be kinder to those around you. And that was really important. There were a few times on the trip that we had to point to that and sort of remind ourselves that that's what we committed to. Because when things get challenging, so for instance, there was a discussion about whether we were going to go through some exposed waters that would mean some bunch of women were going to be feeling really seasick to get to this most southerly base, the Rothera base.
The British base.
The British base. There were some people who had been really excited to go down there. We certainly had a number of Brits on the ship, and it's a fairly famous base, and people wanted to go, but it meant that some people, and there were people who without much swell to the boat, they were feeling miserable pretty quickly. And so we knew that we were going to be putting a bunch of people in that situation. And we had to make a decision about whether we were going to go or not. And it was a very emotionally charged discussion that forced us all to think about if you had a team of coworkers and you were having to make a decision that you knew was going to make
three people sick.
Yeah, not just unhappy, but like sick. You know, how as a leader do you handle that? And how do we collectively have a discussion that feels like everybody's voice was heard? And so it was a great example of how hard it is to work together in respectful ways, let everybody's voice be heard, and yet still move forward.
So with 18 countries, there must have been situations where you were doing everything you knew how to be kind, to be kind.
That actually happened. So there were a group of women who English was not their first language. They would get very frustrated because we would talk too fast. It's difficult to just slow down your pace of talking when you're getting excited about things and you're not trying to tune them out, but it's just hard to do. And they would get very frustrated by the end of the day. They were working so much harder than the rest of us, just trying to keep up with the conversation. The assumptions that we make about what's possible, you know, how much money is available to do things, how you communicate with people, the assumption that everybody has a Facebook page, that that people have public radio, that people have common access to information.
Were there artists, painters, or people who were sketching, or?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, there were a couple of neat art projects that went on. There were some people who, as opposed to writing in a journal, they were doing that sort of facilitated, where they're drawing as someone, you know, they're drawing the lecture as somebody is giving a lecture. And those were just fabulous to look at. We actually had to do 3-minute presentations on what our research was back home. And one of the women would do a sketch for each one of those 3-minute pieces. And they're just a beautiful visual encapsulation of each woman's work. Somebody had printed out a huge map of the Antarctic Peninsula, but on fabric, and then they would sew our route every day in thread, and then we would add pictures of things that we had seen along the way. So another just lovely way to capture the experience.
So is any of that on the Homeward Bound website?
The book is going to be being
put together. Oh, like a
yearbook? It's being put together, the book of our home. And that will all be done digitally. So that'll be something that we'll be able to share. I'm not that artistic. So my little salmon and moose prints and things like that, I'd be a little embarrassed for some of the Homer artists to see it.
But they will be seen.
It'll be seen. We'll share that. But I think it was a good another way to push ourselves and realize that we don't all learn the same. We don't all think the same. We did spend a lot of time talking about communication and how some people really only connect to stories of Sue, tell me about that one penguin. They want to connect on that very specific way. And other people are only interested in, well, what do I do with this information? Where do I take this? And some of us are, show me the graph. So we all learn differently and we all connect differently. So it was nice to sort of explore those different formats. And ultimately, we all came off of the ship with a strategy map, which is just like an organization goes through a strategic planning process. Well, this was basically the same thing, but for each of us individually. It really was profound to me that exploring what your personal values are is really what should be driving how you spend your day, how you decide what you say yes to and what you say no to, and to be fairly ruthless about that. We only have one life on this planet, and if we are doing things that really do not align with who we are in a very deep inner way, then we're wasting our time. It was a hard process. We had cards that we would spread out on the table, like 100 cards of values.
Oh, and you choose
and
the ones.
And we chose the ones that resonated with you. And it really, I had to do it a couple times because I realized I was picking things that sounded good. A good person would have these values, right? And then realizing that they didn't, when you actually had to write what that value meant to you, I couldn't do it for some of those, big ones that sound good. Getting serious about what my values are and how that informs the work that I do and the life that I lead.
What resources do I need in order to act on some of these things? Mm-hmm. Who do I need to make peace with in order to do this? Not to be in conflict with.
Right. And so the outcome of creating that strategic plan is that we each then had to create a 100-day plan for the time that we get off of the ship and what are we going to do in the next 100 days to help us slowly step our way through some of our priorities in that plan.
You have this document that you can go back to over and over again because it's relatively easy to make those plans, but we kind of forget.
Absolutely. There was a lot of conversation about this isn't your New Year's resolution that no one does, that this is really, you are going to put the time into this.
This is a strategic plan.
This is a strategic plan, and it's rooted in your values. That it's the core of who you are. So there's no reason that you can't achieve the things that you've put down there to prioritize in your life or things that you want to accomplish. So it was a, like I said, a very introspective experience, more so than I thought it would be. And realizing that to be a good leader, you first have to know yourself. It starts with yourself. And I really embraced that.
Do you have plans to go back, or maybe you're paving the way for someone else to get there now?
One of the clear things for me is that this network, these women that I was on the ship with, they are now this huge network that I will be engaged with for the rest of my life, you know, in professional or personal ways. And so that is an incredible gift to have. But we also are very aware that there's 7 more teams to go off to Antarctica, and that we want that experience to just be increasingly better and better and better. And so there's a lot of effort right now to distill down what worked and what didn't, and to pass that on to the leadership team so that some of the challenges that we experienced might be a little bit easier for the next team. That any woman who wants to go on this trip, that we embrace them and want this to be as positive experience as possible, in the hopes that we then have 1,000 of us that are really making some of the change that we seek. And
a generational team over years.
Yeah. And actually there were women from 24 on up. So it was
on up to
24 to 60-ish. And that was actually really powerful to have women from many different ages spending that time together.
Have you already identified in your head anyone that you're thinking, this person has to go?
I have already contacted over the year. I was very aware of that there were people that I really wanted to encourage to be part of this. You know, that big picture is really important, and that we raise more women into places where they can be seen and they can be effective. And so that's part of the mission, I think, of Homeward Bound.
That's Sue Mauger, Science Director at Inlet Keeper in Homer. HomewardBoundProjects.com.au is the site to visit to learn about participating in the 2020 expedition. Thanks to our Sea Star Wasting contributors, Brenda Konar and Katrine Eichen. You can see more of their work at GulfWatchAlaska.org. And Education Program Coordinator at the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies, Seth Spencer, has the last word on sea stars.
One thing that I would like to add is that if there are people that are passionate about this or want to share data or become interested in this project, definitely contact the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies, as we're going to continue to do surveys at our 3 plot sites, but of course would love to add more within Kachemak Bay, as there are probably about 10 to 12 data sites throughout Kachemak Bay already, but people don't get out onto the beach every 3 months at a certain low tide. And so some of that data is maybe a year or two old, might not be possibly up on some of the changes that we have been able to see over the winter. That's kind of the powerful thing about being in a community like Homer, is that people are passionate about what's going on around them.
To connect with this research and participate as a citizen scientist, go to akcoastalstudies.org. Thanks for listening. Kachemak Science will be back in 4 weeks with more discussions, presentations, and reviews in the lab, in the classroom, and in the field. We share the data from local science by local scientists.